From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. Organ transplants have become nearly routine, but a shortage of donors means thousands of people wait for new organs.
Only about 0.5% of all deaths occur under circumstances where someone's eligible to be an organ donor, where the brain dies and yet the rest of the body is kept functioning on a ventilator.
Most transplants occur after a tragic death, leading to complicated relationships between donors and recipients.
She and I are intimately connected, but I don't know her. But there's a spiritual aspect. I do have peace with it, but it's a very hard thing, and it's a constant process.
The science, ethics, and emotion of organ transplants. That's our topic this hour on Health Dialogues. We'll get started right after this. And welcome once again to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're taking a 360 look at organ donations and transplants. It's been more than a half century since the first successful organ transplant from a living donor took place. It was a kidney. Today, that surgery is almost routine. In addition, patients now receive lungs, hearts, livers, or a pancreas all over the world, with tremendous success. In fact, the biggest problem these days is a shortage of organs. In California alone, more than 21,000 people are on a waiting list for organs, mostly kidneys. This hour, organ transplants and questions of science, ethics, race and ethnicity, and of course, quality of life. We begin with Gurjeev Sachdeva, a 45-year-old woman who received a double lung transplant in 2007. We recently met up with her at UC San Francisco, where she had her surgery 2.5 years ago. She began by talking with us about her donor, the person whose lungs are now hers.
You know, she and I are intimately connected, but I don't know her. But there's a spiritual aspect. I have to feel comfortable with she's a part of me, and she helps me climb through the Marin Headlands and bike and so forth. And I want to have, I do have peace with it, but it's a very hard thing, and it's a constant process.
Gurjeev Sachdeva was born in India. She came to the U.S. when she was 2 years old. Gurjeev was a healthy woman in her early 30s, a practicing attorney, when she developed a cough that wouldn't go away. She was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis, a condition that slowly destroyed her lungs.
Did you ever have anything like that in your family, or was it completely out of the blue?
It was completely out of the blue. My mom does have rheumatoid arthritis, which I developed later, and sometimes that sort of autoimmune disease tends to sometimes have a lung aspect to it.
And you never smoked or anything?
Not a single thing, legal or illegal.
So what did you, as you came to the realization that you were going to need a lung transplant, how did you react?
It was too hard to comprehend. I was and am a very independent person anyway, didn't want to have to rely on people, didn't even want to think about the very hard parts of what it must be like to be on a transplant list and, you know, wait for some young kid to have a motorcycle accident or some such tragedy. It's emotionally overwhelming.
Gurjeev's condition deteriorated over a period of 7 or 8 years. As she got sicker, she tried to hide her growing shortness of breath from her coworkers at a law firm. Eventually, in October 2006, she went on the transplant list for a new lung.
At one point, I recall I, you know, got up at 6 or 6:30 in the morning to get ready for work. And, you know, you wash your face, you have to sit down on the bed for a while. You brush your teeth, you have to sit down on the bed for a while. You know, by the time you roll into work, it's 10:30 or 11 because it just takes so long, so much effort to get yourself dressed in the morning and out the door.
And you would have to take your oxygen with you to work.
I actually didn't. Were you
still hiding it at that point?
I was still hiding it. And then I think during that summer, I coughed so hard that I collapsed a lung. So I spent about a week in the hospital then, and that's the summer where I started declining, and then I finally had to come clean with everybody.
What was it like for you emotionally, being on that list, waiting, and as you say, waiting for tragedy, really, for someone else?
It wound up taking longer than I expected. It was about 9 months. And sometimes you would get comments from other people about, oh, is your surgery planned? And I would stop and say, no, it's not planned. I'm really waiting for you know, something horrible to happen. My lungs are still walking around in somebody's body, and I don't want to hasten it.
So it's kind of an emotional conflict in a way.
It's totally an emotional conflict. I got to say that waiting is very, very hard also. You're constantly bags packed, ready to go to the airport, and you don't know when the flight is going to come. You know, the call is going to come in for the flight. So after a while, you get used to the fact that you are pretty much on oxygen 24 hours a day. I actually had a lot of my shades just closed because I couldn't deal with, you know, all of the life going on outside. And so my mom and my then boyfriend were kind of trading off and spending half the week with me at a time. And we did indoor things, you know, thank God for the Warriors were doing well, you know, Netflix, TiVo, reading books, talking to people on the phone, trying to stay busy and try to focus on happy things and staying healthy, as well as, you know, to the extent you can, you move around and try to, as Dr. Hoops would say, stay ready for surgery. And that's spiritually, emotionally, physically, to the extent you can.
Dr. Hoops is the director of cardiopulmonary transplantation at UCSF. He performed Gurdjieff's double lung transplant.
As organ transplants go, how difficult is the match for a lung transplant?
It depends a lot on size and also a lot on antibodies. So in this particular part of the country, because we have a relatively diverse population, it's much more challenging on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast because we tend to be less insular. Particularly at the University of California, we have a relatively diverse ethnicity in our population base. We also have a relatively diverse ethnicity in our donor population base, and the two of those together are compatible, but it makes antibody issues somewhat more challenging on the West Coast, and my experience has been on the East Coast.
And what does it mean to you to see a patient go from almost no lung function to, you know, theoretically being able to run a marathon?
It's good, and that's how I got interested in it, was just there were very few operations we had in cardiothoracic surgery that gave you as much bang for your buck as a lung transplant, where someone could come in literally wheelchair-bound on oxygen and within 2 or 3 days be up kind of jogging in the hallway. There are not many operations we have outside of lung transplant and give you that kind of quality of life gain in a relatively short period of time.
When an organ becomes available and a match is found, nurse Karen Breen, a heart and lung transplant coordinator at UCSF, gets to call a patient and tell them that their wait is over.
It's the most exciting thing that a nurse can do on a job is to call someone in. It's the best.
What's that like?
I have one of my favorite stories. I was coming back from a doctor's appointment. I was on call on a weekend, and my pager rang, and it was our surgeon, and he asked me to call this patient in who happened to be this very, very sweet patient that I had grown very close to. And I picked up my folder, called her up, and told her good morning. And she said, good morning. And I said, have you had breakfast? And she says, well, I was just getting ready to eat. And I said, well, you can't. She said, wait a minute, this is Saturday. And I said, that's right, and we need you to get over to the hospital right away. I'm still getting goosebumps. We believe we have some organs for you. And she proceeded to kind of gasp for air for a minute and said, I'll be right there. And I hung up the phone, and I was sitting there with a big smile on my face, feeling very good about myself. And I turned to look at my husband, and he looked at me, and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, that is just the best.
Gurdjieff remembers vividly when she got her phone call 2.5 years ago.
At about 7:30 in the morning, there was a phone call. There was one of the transplant nurses on the line, and I could hear a dog barking in the background. And she verified that I was who I was, and she said, Dr. Hoops wants you to come to the hospital for your transplant. You know, and then she started going to specifics, show up here, be there within the hour, et cetera.
What did they tell you about the donor?
Well, I actually only found out about a month or so ago details of my donor. The family had written back to me, but it was a letter that got lost in the system and only recently recovered. And it's just heartbreaking. I think that for a couple of weeks, I just thought about it every morning and every night and had a hard time sleeping. It was a graduate student at Berkeley, a young woman who had died in a bicycle accident. And I have my own survivor guilt, and I started reading into the circumstances because this is the internet age. There was a heck of a lot still online about the accident and so much about her, including her own blog, her Amazon wish list, etc. You know, and I started thinking, well, the person who was with her in the biking with her survived it, and that guy might have his own survivor guilt. The person who hit them might have their own survivor guilt. It's something we have to live with. It's a really hard thing to realize that someone who was, well, anybody, but someone who was younger than you especially, died. And you ask yourself every day, was my life worth saving? Am I doing all the right things? You're supposed to eat heart healthy, but sometimes you just feel like having cookies. You know, you try to take it all in balance, but there's a whole lot of soul searching.
Have you thought about meeting the family and friends of the donor?
I have. They don't live in the area, so that makes it a little bit difficult. But I have thought about getting back in touch with some of her friends at Berkeley, since I don't think it would be too hard to do that. And I think it will be extremely difficult on both ends. I'm not sure how my news 2.5 years later that, hey, I'm the person who got her lungs and I live in San Francisco, which is not that far away. I would love to meet you. That's something they would have to her closest friends would have to take time to process too, as the social worker has reminded me. People have to take their own time to get used to these things.
You can imagine, though, also how they might feel grateful, you know, that part of her is still alive in you, and that although she died a horribly tragic death, something good came out of it.
I certainly hope so. I mean, I'm thinking about if I can get my act in gear actually doing a bike ride, a charity bike ride this summer, which is happening on my anniversary. And I thought, wouldn't it be a nice thing if I do get in touch with these people, and what if they wanted to do something with me? Because they're most of them are bikers anyway. That would be a really nice way to honor her.
Gurjeev Sachdeva, we talked with her at UC San Francisco, where she received a double lung transplant in 2007. Any way you look at it, matching organ recipients and donors is a complicated business. The California Transplant Donor Network, or CTDN, coordinates the recovery and distribution of organs in 40 counties in parts of California and Nevada. The CTDN is a nonprofit organ procurement organization, one of the nation's largest. We went to see two people who play critical roles there. Thomas Wood, a surgical coordinator who figures out the logistics of getting donated organs to patients who need them, and Sharon Swain, nurse educator at the CTDN in San Francisco.
Where does your job begin in this? Where do you get involved?
So I become involved when a hospital makes a referral on a patient who has sustained a severe brain injury. And we come to the hospital and we begin an evaluation of the patient as a potential organ and tissue donor.
So basically you want to do a kind of a pre-screen.
That's right.
Yeah. So once they pass that and you realize, okay, this is a person whose life is about to end, essentially, and they may be donors, potentially. So what do you do then?
So then we initiate a discussion with the family, and we, first of all, provide them grief support, and we walk them through the process of the fact that their loved one has died, and we then begin to introduce the option of organ donation. And then we begin a medical workup of the patient once that process of consent has been taken place.
And these are people generally that haven't thought about having an organ donated from a loved one up until this point?
Some people are already aware of donation, and so when you introduce donation to them, it's a natural segue into wanting their loved one to be a donor. Sometimes they haven't thought about donation at all. So it really just depends on where that person is, how educated they are about the process, how educated they are about donation in general, and then moving forward from there.
And of course, you're interacting with them at one of the worst moments in their lives. They're dealing with grief and all kinds of things. What kinds of concerns do they have?
They often have concerns around whether we're going to treat their loved one with respect. They're concerns about mutilation. We let them know that we treat their loved ones with the utmost of respect, that we honor the gift that this family is giving to us and giving to recipients.
It's a tricky balancing act, I imagine, because you're there because you want to get those organs, really. I mean, that's just a crude way of saying it. You want to save somebody's life on the other end of that agreement. So, and yet, I imagine you don't want to convey that, you know, because you have to be very empathetic and all those things. It's a complicated conversation, isn't it?
Really, our number one goal in this is it's not organs first, but it is to take care of the families first and to provide them grief support and comfort in their most difficult hours. And if we have taken care of a family first, whether they say yes or no to donation, as long as we know we've provided good care for that family, we have done our job for the day. And really, obtaining consent for organ donation is secondary to that.
Getting to that point of brain death, describe what happens in the body and how do they determine, and that happens before you get there, right?
Sometimes it happens before we get there, and sometimes we are notified prior to the event happening. So what happens is your brain controls everything that you do. It controls your blood pressure, and it controls your temperature, and it controls your breathing patterns and all of your reflexes. And it also allows you to interact with one another and be present with one another. When you cut off the blood supply to the brain, all of those functions cease. And that person who you knew as your son or your daughter or your brother, they are no longer there in that capacity. We can do a series of tests to determine if that brain function has ceased. We can check for if the reflexes are present or if they're absent. We can also check for a blood supply to the brain. We can check to see if the breathing centers are working. And when all those things are absent, then that person can be declared brain dead.
So that declaration of brain death, is there anything anybody could do to reverse that? Or once that's made, the person is deceased, essentially?
That's right. So brain death is different from a coma. If a person were in a coma, they would actually still have some brainstem reflexes present that we could see and test for. Once the person no longer has a blood supply to the brain actually begins its own decomposition process. And without a blood supply and without oxygen, the brain will actually decompose, and there is no chance of coming back from that once that process has begun.
Yeah. And once that determination is made and once the family is given consent, the clock is running. What has to happen in order to match the donor up with the recipient?
So we, at that point, then begin our workup, and we look at blood type, at size, at height. We run blood tests for communicable diseases. We also send blood to do some tissue typing. And we take all of that information, and then we put it all into our computer system, and then it goes into a database that will then generate a list to determine the best matches to that donor.
When you look at the list in California of people waiting for organs, there's about 21,000 plus people on that list, and the vast majority of them are looking for kidneys. Why is that? Why are kidneys by far the most needed organ?
Things like high blood pressure, which if people don't see a physician on a regular basis, they don't necessarily know that they have high blood pressure. And high blood pressure, if not treated, can be very damaging to organs and especially can be damaging to kidneys. And so we see a lot of people on the kidney waiting list because they do have damage from these diseases like diabetes, like hypertension.
Yeah. Well, let's bring Thomas in over here. You get that phone call. Is it a phone call?
Yeah. When I get a phone call, I'll get a list, and the list will go something like this. Let's say it's a young donor, and because they're young and healthy, all their organs are a good match for somebody. So they might say, okay, Thomas, we've got a donor out in Modesto, for example. Now, UCSF is going to take the liver and the kidneys. Stanford wants the pancreas. Stanford wants the heart. So from that point, once I've been given this list, then they say, okay, you've got 4 hours to get there. Sometimes it's five. Usually it's closer to 4 hours.
And when you say you've got 4 hours, meaning you have 4 hours to get the organ there or the team there, what?
typically a team will go out for every major organ. So a team will go out for the heart, a team will go out for the lungs, a team will go out for the liver. And then it's a matter of picking everybody up. I always use the analogy of it's like being the mother of a road trip. Step one, after we've made all of our phone calls, after we've done all the coordination saying, Dr. So-and-so, we need you here, we need the car here at this time, we need the plane here at this time. Once all that's set up and arranged, then we would come here to our lab where we've got all of our equipment. So,
what do we got here?
So first thing is we would get a cooler out. So we've got just a normal giant-sized igloo cooler. Inside of that is going to be what we call frozen slush or saline. I can show you over here.
These are all refrigerators here?
Yeah, so inside this refrigerator is probably the most important part of what we bring. This is the cold storage solution. A big part of the surgery, a key part of the surgery, is called cross-clamp. Cross-clamp is the holy grail of numbers when it comes to organ donation. Cross-clamp is the point when the natural circulation of blood stops and we put in, we perfuse is the word, a cold storage solution. I like to call it Gatorade for organs. And so we would hang on an IV pool, say, 5 or 6 liters of this. And the second that they clamp off all the circulation of the body, they start perfusing in this for, solution. And that's one of the key parts of my job.
So you have to bring that with you.
Yeah. So we bring that with us. By taking the blood out and putting this solution in, we are able to have it in a sort of nutrient-rich bath. It is a cold solution because you want to get everything cold right away to stop metabolism. So we'll take a different fluid depending on what organs we're taking. A big part of my job is also making sure that everything that is meant to go with the organ, so this is paperwork, this is blood, this is tissue, does go with the organ. If you look inside here, we see that this is a cardboard box with a styrofoam lining on the inside. And we've got two different biohazard bags, one wrapped on the inside, one on the outside. You would put, for example, a kidney inside the Nalgene container, and you would fill that with some of the cold storage solution that we showed you. Then you would take that and wrap it in three plastic bags, sterile bags. And then we fill it with a bunch of ice, and then we put blood and the chart inside, wrap it up, tape it, seal it, and the kidney's done.
Wow. Off you go.
There's serious timing issues where what you have to consider is from the point when it's removed from the body, for a heart, for example, which is the organ that can stand being out of the body for the least amount of time, we've got a matter of like 4 hours, actually less than that. Usually they want it to get back from place to place in, say, 2.5 hours. So we might be down in San Diego and then want to fly up and get the heart to Stanford as quickly as possible. So we're calculating how long does it take to get from the OR down to the car. That's 4 minutes. From the car to the airport, that's 12 minutes. From the airport directly into Moffitt, that's going to be 1 hour and 17 minutes. And you start adding all this up.
I assume this is all private jets.
Yeah. It's one of the most unfortunate things of transplant that the system just needs to be perfect, and it's expensive.
This is a high-pressure operation.
There's an interesting thing that one has to appreciate when they come in this company, especially when it's people that are going to be working on the clinical side with the donors directly. And that is that every time you go to work, every time you get called, it means somebody's died. And you can flip that around and say, well, you know, we're going to have 2 or 3 people live. We're going to have 4 people live. But when you go on site, we don't really get to see the end result as immediately. We go out and there's a family that's suffering and there's somebody lying out that despite being brain death, and so legally dead, and so medically and clinically defined as dead in the state of California, you know, we see a person, and they have a temperature, and they have a pulse, and it can be very affecting in that way.
That's Thomas Wood, surgical coordinator at the California Transplant Donor Network in San Francisco. Before him, we heard his colleague there, Sharon Swain. If you'd like to explore some interactive charts about transplants in California, head to our website, healthdialogues.org. Compare how organ recipients and the current waitlist break down by ethnicity. See which organs are in highest demand. and find out who's most likely to give you an organ, your sister or your husband. Again, it's all at our website, healthdialogues.org.
On the April edition of Health Dialogues, we look at how the state serves the developmentally disabled. Department of Developmental Services recently announced that it wants to close a Southern California facility which provides 24-hour care. We'll explore what this closure might mean for the community, and we'll take a look at other services trying to bridge the care gap. That's next month on Health Dialogues.
And welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. When he was an investigative journalist with the Los Angeles Times, Charles Ornstein did extensive coverage of organ transplantation in California. Today, he's a senior reporter with ProPublica, a nonprofit journalism organization based in New York City. And Charles Ornstein joins us now. Charlie, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott. Nice to be here.
Charlie, over the years, you have reported on extensive problems with transplant programs at Kaiser in San Francisco, UC Irvine's Medical Center in Orange, USC's liver transplant program. And those problems ranged from excessive waiting times for patients to high death rates after surgery. Describe, if you would, some of the details of the problems you uncovered.
Well, we were looking at public data about organ transplantation. And the field of organ transplantation is one in which there's quite a lot of public information, one of the best areas of medicine to actually find statistics. And as we were looking at it, things were jumping out at us as being irregular or improper. At UC Irvine, for instance, back in 2005, we had talked about how more than 30 people died waiting for liver transplants, even as the hospital was turning down scores of organs that could have saved them. And they didn't have a full-time liver transplant surgeon on staff, but were instead relying on doctors 90 miles away who worked at UC San Diego.
And what were the kinds of reactions that you got from a place like UC Irvine? Did they make changes? And I know some of the facilities actually shut down as a result of your reporting.
That's right. At UC Irvine, they closed their liver transplant program the day our story broke. We also wrote a story in 2006 about problems at Kaiser Permanente's kidney transplant program in San Francisco, which was quite a large program. And they had forced patients in Northern California to switch from UC San Francisco and UC Davis into Kaiser's own program, but they weren't equipped to handle it. And so they had hundreds of patients transfer onto their waiting lists, but they weren't equipped to provide them with organs. So at Kaiser, in the early years of their program, twice as many people were dying waiting for organs as were receiving kidneys. And in other programs, it was the exact opposite. Several days after our story ran about the problems at Kaiser's program, they announced that they would shut down their kidney transplant program.
There are different kinds of problems with a program like this. There are quality of care issues. There could be ethical lapses. And I'm wondering, in the reporting that you did, a lot of it 5-6 years ago now, would you say that there was a common theme to the issues that you uncovered?
I think the common theme was that people weren't really either looking at the data or acting on it, that a lot of these trends and a lot of these problems were apparent when you looked at the number of surgeries that programs performed or their mortality rates. And both the federal regulators that oversee the Medicare program as well as the transplant community may have asked questions, but they didn't inform patients that they were at a riskier center or take action when centers didn't take steps to improve.
Why would that be? Why would such a high-profile program as organ transplantation not get the kind of oversight within a facility, do you think?
I think two things were going on. First, as I mentioned, the field of organ transplantation is one where lots of data is available. This was one of those cases where it could have been seen that transparency was the solution rather than just one step. What I mean by that is that by posting the information, there was the assumption that patients would do their research and that centers would want to improve on their own, and that that was in itself the incentive to improve. But that wasn't always the case. Secondarily, I think that within the transplant community and among federal regulators, there was the feeling that if you worked with folks to improve, they would eventually improve. And if the ultimate goal was not to punish, but rather to improve the care, that by working with folks enough, that it would happen.
One of the cases you uncovered was at the St. Vincent Medical Center in Los Angeles, and it involved a Saudi Arabian man who apparently jumped to the front of the line for a new organ. Tell us a little bit about that case and what protections and safeguards are in place now as a result of that reporting you did.
Well, St. Vincent Medical Center actually discovered itself that one of its doctors had improperly arranged for a transplant to a Saudi national using an organ that should have gone to a much higher priority patient at another hospital. They also discovered that hospital staff members had falsified documents several times to cover up this maneuver, pretended that the transplant had gone to a different patient who was near the top of the list, and continued to cover it up subsequently. St. Vincent closed the liver transplant program after this came to light. They faced a lot of bad press, and just this January, the surgeon who was in charge of the liver transplant program was indicted by a federal grand jury for lying to the National Organ Transplant Network about this transplant.
Now, we should point out that stories, all of these stories, are relatively rare, right? These are the exceptions in programs like this.
These are the exceptions, but I think that patients who are gravely ill and require transplants are so reliant on the system to protect them. And these cases are simply, you know, unacceptable. I think if you talk to the regulatory community and if you talk to folks in the organ transplant system, they've learned a lot from these cases. They learned that they had to be more proactive. They learned that there was a limit to the number of chances you should give a program. And I think that they also felt that patients should be informed, for instance, if doctors didn't have full-time surgeons working on their staffs, that it was a patient's right to know that. Whereas before, it was just assumed that programs would do the right thing. Now I think that there's backstops in place.
That case of the Saudi national who jumped to the front of the line recalls the case, not that they're the same, but it's the same kind of fear people have of Steve Jobs of Apple, who got a liver transplant in Tennessee. There are other reasons he got a liver relatively quickly. The waiting list in Tennessee is pretty short. In your reporting, is this one of the sort of, I don't know if myth is the right word, but certainly a concern that may be exaggerated based on what you found?
I think that there are two big concerns. The first is that folks can jump to the front of the line if they have money. And the second is that doctors will have an incentive to declare a patient dead in an effort to collect their organs before they actually are dead. And those are two great concerns. And unfortunately, you know, there, as in the case of the Saudi national, as is the case of a couple incidents we discovered, you know, things happen rarely that call into question the ethics of folks who perform transplants. But I do think that by and large, from all we saw, you know, this really is the exception and not the rule.
And of course, maintaining the integrity of the system is critical, because if you don't have the trust of donors, you're going to have people very reluctant to sign up to give an organ, right?
The integrity is absolutely critical. I think the transplant community was very concerned about a criminal case that took place in San Luis Obispo last year involving a surgeon who was called in to do a certain type of organ harvesting after a patient would die. And he was accused of hastening the patient's death. He was acquitted of those charges. But I think folks in the transplant community were very concerned about the public's reaction and the effect that this could have on donation rates and on folks' trust that they place in the system.
Charlie, I know that you focused your reporting on California. Do you have any sense of how California compares to other states in terms of the quality of the transplantation programs and the safeguards that are in place?
California's safeguards and the process that's in place is the same as with other states, because these are rules that are dictated by the National Organ Network and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So everybody is entitled to the same protections. Where California really differs, however, is that there's a huge need for organs, and there are not as many donors as in other areas. And so the wait times for transplants are dramatically longer than in many other parts of the country.
Why is that? Why is it so much harder to get organs?
It could be a cultural thing. It could be that folks are less willing to donate. It could be that the need for organs is greater. But as you noted with Steve Jobs, was able to go to Tennessee and get an organ much more quickly than he would have been able to in California. And you find that time and again. Right now, you have a patient who sued Anthem Blue Cross because Anthem refused to pay for the person to get a transplant in Indiana, where transplants can happen in a matter of weeks, but instead wanted the patient to remain in California, where transplants can take years. This is sort of built-in unfairness in the transplant system, not because of anything nefarious, but because of the way the system works and geographic variation in organ donation.
As a result of all the reporting you did, Charlie, what changes, if any, were made at the national level in terms of oversight?
Big changes. What we had found was that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which runs the federal Medicare program, that they were not enforcing their standards as far as the death rates that programs had to have and the number of transplants that they had to perform in order to maintain their proficiency. So the federal government put out new rules, and they're now enforcing it. So dozens of programs that had previously been authorized to get federal funding no longer do. They may not perform transplants at all, or they may just not get federal funding, but this really caused a lot of hospitals to soul search and determine, is transplantation an area of excellence for them, and should they continue with it? So I think that's a real benefit.
All right. Charles Orenstein, a senior reporter with ProPublica. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
We asked the four California-based hospitals mentioned in our conversation with Charlie Orenstein to comment on past problems with their transplant programs, and here's what they said. Kaiser San Francisco acknowledged that the administration of its kidney transplant program fell short of its goals. The HMO says it learned from those mistakes and applied those lessons to the care of patients post-transplant. USC says it overhauled its liver transplant policies and procedures, purchased a new patient tracking system, and hired a surgical director of liver transplantation. St. Vincent Medical Center in Los Angeles says it cooperated with a federal investigation into a surgeon indicted for wrongly helping a Saudi national get a liver transplant ahead of someone else who was first on the list. That surgeon no longer works at St. Vincent Medical Center. UC Irvine declined to comment, other than to say its liver transplant program remains closed. Deciding whether or not to donate your organs when you die is, of course, a very personal decision. We went to the place where most people in California sign up to be donors, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and asked folks there if they themselves are donors and why or why not.
I don't have a real direct answer on why I'm not an organ donor, but I definitely should be one because my blood type is O negative, which means I am able to give to anyone.
I'm about to renew my license right now, and I was about to change my mind. In fact, I'm not sure if I'm going to remain an organ donor, basically because of myths that you hear about. For example, that if you're an organ donor, that if you have an accident, they're not going to take the same care as if you were not.
I'm an organ donor because if I ever have to go, I'd like to help someone out who needs whatever organs I'm not going to be using because I'll be dead. So pass the love, you know?
I am an organ donor because I think it's important to give back to other people, particularly when you're gone. You know, you have organs that are healthy, and so there's no point in letting them go to waste when other people can be blessed by them.
That was Aisha Brown, Rafael Castillo, Alex Kara Georgievich, and Shay Lewis at the Department of Motor Vehicles in San Francisco. It's something we don't even really think about much, why the place we sign up to be an organ donor is the DMV. Reporter Sarah Varney wanted to understand just exactly how that happened.
It's an odd place to ponder your mortality, standing in line under the fluorescent lights waiting for your number to be called. But somehow it seems oddly fitting, too. It's the only place in California where nearly everyone passes through. The one turnstile where rich and poor, young and old, Republicans and Democrats bump into each other. What better place, then, to contemplate our shared fate? Registering to become an organ donor at the DMV is an accident of history, or rather the history of accidents, says Art Kaplan, a bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania.
Back in the late 60s, you obtained organs for transplant, say a heart or a liver, from people who were in motor vehicle accidents. That was the prime source of organs. So it made some sense at that time to say, well, let's ask people when they get to motor vehicles if they'd want to be organ donors.
Kaplan says by the early 1970s, most states had adopted programs.
Back in the early days, motorcycles around medical centers were referred to as donor cycles. That's how common it was to have somebody with a fatal head injury wind up being an organ donor.
Thankfully, motor vehicles, even motorcycles, are far safer now. But organ donation is a numbers game. And though it sounds macabre, it takes a lot of deaths to get just one organ donor.
Less than 1 in 100 deaths actually qualifies to be an organ donor at the time of death because of the special circumstances.
Those circumstances, says Brian Stewart, president of the donor registry Donate Life California, involve finding a person who's pronounced brain dead and has healthy enough organs to benefit someone in need. The only way to increase the odds of finding an organ donor, says Stewart, is to get the greatest number of people signed up.
So if we're trying to make a decision as important as organ donation and to enable as many people as possible to make that decision, then the DMV is a natural place to do it because it's universal access.
And by one measure, the DMV system is remarkably successful. 98% of registered donors in California come from the DMV. The rest come from the online donor registry. But on the measure that matters the most, the percentage of Californians signed up as donors, California's performance is dismal. About 1 in 4 residents have registered, among the lowest rates in the nation. That's led some to wonder if primary care physicians should play a bigger role in organ donation. After all, DMV clerks don't have the time or the training to discuss such a profound decision.
Now 30, V210, at window number 20.
I think that having discussions at the doctor's offices about organ donation would be a good idea.
Brian Dolan was at the DMV near San Francisco's Golden Gate Park recently.
I don't think anybody really understands what organ donation is, what happens to your body if you're in an accident and you have organs which can be useful for other people.
Talking to a doctor sounded like a good idea to Alex Karadjordjevich, who was also at the San Francisco DMV.
Well, yeah, actually, weirdly enough, I never really get asked by a doctor whenever I have checkups.
And that made me think, you know what? My own doctor hasn't brought it up either.
Knock, knock.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dr. Dobro. How are you?
Robert Dobro is an earnest and conscientious physician with a small practice in San Francisco. Dr. Dobro says even though the primary method of organ designation remains at the DMV, physicians are being urged to talk about it.
It's becoming a what we call quality indicator. The federal government, Medicare, insurers, they look at doctors' performances and to determine how well a doctor's doing and ultimately how much a doctor will get paid. And one of these pay-for-performance parameters is having discussed end-of-life care issues with patients and having advanced directives on file.
He pulls out a simple-looking 4-page form, a healthcare directive, that he can give to patients and keep in their medical record. The directive spells out whether a patient wants to be on a respirator, prefers to be resuscitated or not, and if the patient wants to be an organ donor. But Dr. Dobro says discussing end-of-life issues is yet one more thing primary care doctors are expected to do in their limited time with patients. And he finds the patients he does manage to give the form to don't seem particularly eager.
Most of the people that I give the form to don't return it, but it's a concept and it's being introduced, and the more that it's talked about and discussed, and the better we'll be at getting those forms back and in the charts.
State and national organ donor experts say clearly doctors are better suited than DMV clerks at discussing end-of-life care. But they say moving registration away from DMV, a highly centralized government bureaucracy with one computer system, to a fragmented healthcare system with tens of thousands of doctors, hundreds of health plans, uneven use of electronic medical records, and vast numbers of uninsured who don't see a doctor would be disastrous. Instead, they say the push for organ donors should come on all fronts. University of Pennsylvania bioethicist Kaplan says doctors can play a key role, but so too should those who counsel people about dying.
If you're a priest or rabbi or imam or whoever says, this Sunday I want to talk about organ donation, that's going to have a lot of weight for many people in a way that if the doctor says, let's spend a second talking about organ donation, might not.
Whether or not to benefit others when you die, says Kaplan, is for many people more a religious and ethical issue than a medical one. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
More than two-thirds of the Californians waiting for organ transplants are minorities. Almost half live in Southern California. Historically, people of color have been far less likely than whites to register as organ donors. The reasons range from mistrust of the healthcare system to language and cultural barriers. But that's changing. In recent years, as a result of education and outreach, the donor registration and consent rates have risen, especially among Latinos. From Los Angeles, reporter Deborah Baer has this story.
So this is my daughter.
Oh, how beautiful.
This is when she was born, and for her first year.
At her home in Riverside, Perla Carrillo is at the kitchen table showing me a family photo album of her little daughter, Perlita.
She was lovable, happy. She always had a smile. This is her last Christmas. The last Christmas we spent together.
The album was made by relatives as a tribute to Perlita's short life. She died at the age of 2.5.
She already knew her colors, and she knew her ABCs, too. The day that my son was born, I think it was my sister who brought the balloons and said, it's a boy. And Perlita spelled the words. I told everybody, look, everybody, come and listen. I want you to show you that Perlita knows her letters. And she started saying, letter by letter.
The joy of a new life and the tragedy of sudden death visited the Carrillo family in one short weekend 8 years ago. The morning after her first son was born, while Perla was recovering in the maternity ward, her daughter Perlita was brought to the emergency room of the same hospital after being sick all night. The doctor's diagnosis was grave.
He told me that my daughter was suffering from a brain tumor. And because she had been throwing up, that made the tumor burst.
Following surgery, the next day, just 2 days after she gave birth to her son, Perla received this news from the doctor.
Then my daughter was brain dead, and there was just nothing else for us to do. It was heartbreaking. It was really difficult. It's something that I couldn't believe. When reality hits, it's just so hard and so difficult.
A little while later, at the hospital, Perla says, a social worker from One Legacy met with her and Perlita's father. One Legacy is the nonprofit that manages organ donations in the greater Los Angeles area.
She has more information. Actually, she helped us more than the doctor to understand what we were going through. The way she talked to me and the way she talked to my ex-husband, it was very comforting at that moment. And she told us about donating.
Though it was something Perla had never considered, the decision came quickly.
I know we were both really in pain, but I know it was something that we knew that Perlita would be very happy to do. And I know she helped me and her dad make that decision.
The family's priest supported the decision. Perlita Carrillo's liver was donated to a one-year-old. Her kidneys went to two men in their 30s. All three recipients are alive today.
We are relying on the goodwill of neighbor to help neighbor at a time when a family may be feeling no goodwill at all.
Brian Stewart is with One Legacy. He's also president of Donate Life California, which operates the state's donor registry. While 6 million Californians have registered as donors, organ donations are actually rare.
Only about 0.5% of all deaths occur under circumstances where someone's eligible to be an organ donor, where the brain dies and yet the rest of the body is kept functioning on a ventilator.
With numbers like those, Stewart says, it's critical to get the word out to every ethnic community. A decade ago, fewer than half of Latinos consented to donate, but in recent years, they've been responding to the message.
2 out of 3 Latino families are saying yes to donation or their loved one was registered.
Latinos are now the largest number of donors in L.A. County. Stewart credits One Legacy's Latino counselors who both speak the language and understand the culture. At a recent annual ceremony thanking families and memorializing 68 donors, more than 400 family members turned out, many of them still grieving. The ceremony was conducted entirely in Spanish.
Usted ha llegado a enfrentar la muerte,
You have been confronted with death. It arrived unknown, without any preparation, without any map to guide you on the path.
Keynote speaker Luz Diaz is a family care specialist with one legacy. She works with families for at least 2 years after an organ donation. Family members at the event also heard from heart transplant recipient Jesus Nava.
After my heart transplant, I realized that everybody can do a little bit to help others. For this, we are eternally grateful to you. Thank you very much.
Some arrive at the decision to donate their loved one's organs easily. Others anguish over it, like retired Los Angeles County Sheriff Sergeant Herman Treviso. His 15-year-old son, Chris, was declared brain dead and spent several days on life support after being shot in the head by another teenager.
My wife was literally pulling her hair out because I was saying no, 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 and she wanted it done, and I just kept saying no.
Herman says his son Chris was a generous boy with a promising future. He was an excellent athlete with a big appetite for In-N-Out burgers, which they enjoyed together after every baseball practice.
I still had that hope that he was going to come back. I still wanted him to live. I said, even if he's on a machine and if he smiles at me, I'll go for that. But obviously it wasn't going to happen. So when I found out that he was going to be gone, that's when I said, okay. I'll sign the papers and maybe we can help somebody else.
Then something remarkable happened. The family found out that their son's kindergarten teacher was near death in the same hospital. She was a kidney dialysis patient low on the transplant list and unlikely to survive the long wait for an organ. Donor families are allowed to will organs to people of their choosing, so they gave the teacher one of Chris's kidneys.
He saved his teacher and two other people.
Miss Whiteside has been doing well, sending postcards and pictures from her travels to Hawaii and other destinations. Oddly enough, Herman says, she developed some unusual food cravings after the transplant.
She has a craving for In-N-Outs, the burger. And she told us she doesn't like hamburger, but she craves the In-N-Out burger. So some of it, you know, passes on. It passes on, you know, in that form. So that makes me feel good because that's my Chris. That's my boy right there.
For Health Dialogues, I'm Deborah Baer.
We have some interactive charts on our website that let you see how California donors, recipients, and the current transplant wait list all break down by ethnicity. You'll find them at healthdialogues.org. And finally, we have an update to a transplant story that aired in December. We introduced you back then to two sisters, Sherry and Toni Brown. Sherry was waiting to receive a new kidney, while her sister Toni was planning to donate one of her kidneys to a stranger who needed one. Those operations in that donor chain happened in mid-February, and both sisters are doing well. That's all the time we have for today. Don't forget, everything you just heard and much more is available on our website. It's healthdialogues.org. We also have a special web-only audio slideshow this month. See photos and hear Victor Zabaya share his own personal story of his kidney transplant. Again, it's all at our website, healthdialogues.org. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. The Health Dialogues team includes Polly Stryker, Susie Rocho, Gabriel Cohen, Nick Vidinsky, Erica Kelly, and Shuka Kalantari. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.